Welcome to another episode of Nip Tuck Talk Radio. This is your host, Michelle Garber. And today we're going to be talking about a very important subject, anesthesia. And with me is Dr. Barry Friedberg, who's an anesthesiologist practicing in Southern California. He's also the author of a book, Getting Over, Going Under, Five Things You Must Know Before Anesthesia. Please stay tuned for this very important subject.
The bottom line, says Friedberg, don't let your parents, your spouse, or anybody you love over 50 years old get general anesthesia without a brain monitor, or you may never speak to the same person again.
Part of my thing for doing the technique I do is I don't want anybody to hurt or be hurt under anesthesia under my watch. I don't think it's acceptable, and it's certainly readily avoidable through measurement.
Join cosmetic surgery Nip Tuck coach, beauty expert, and author of Safety First, A Consumer Guide to Cosmetic Surgery, Michelle Garber. Michelle's goal is to empower listeners and help them make safe cosmetic surgery procedure choices. Your host, Michelle Garber, is here today to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic surgery.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Garber. If you don't know me, I'm the founder of Nip Tuck Coach, an independent cosmetic procedure consultancy, and I'm a patient advocate. I work with clients directly, helping them to make safe, informed decisions about any aesthetic procedures. I'm also a support system, helping them throughout their surgical or rejuvenation journey. Not all surgeons or doctors are equally trained or skilled. There is more to choosing a surgeon than where they went to medical school or how many stars they have on Yelp and RealSelf. I'm committed to safety and aesthetics and have an ebook for listeners to download for free at my website, which is www.niptuckcoach.com. So one of the scariest parts of having elective surgical procedures or plastic surgery or any surgical procedure, I think, is anesthesia. And also the understanding of you have to let go of control. And then the questions go through your head as to, will you wake up? Will you be nauseous? Will you be vomiting? Will you feel anything? And I've had several elective procedures. I've had several non-elective procedures. And when I went under general anesthesia, I remember waking up feeling nauseous, vomiting, sore throat. And I also remember once I felt like really jittery, like I was jumping out of my skin. It was a outpatient procedure. And I remember coming home and I couldn't get rid of that feeling of jumping out of my skin. And it was horrible. It was just a really horrible feeling. About four years ago now was the first time that I had MAC anesthesia. Afterwards, I woke up, there was no nausea, there was no vomiting, there was no sore throat. My recovery was much better, and it was great. It was a great drug. I mean, I really felt terrific right afterwards. And so for me, that was probably the best anesthesia experience that I've ever had. So today with me, I'm delighted to have Dr. Barry Friedberg. And Dr. Friedberg is a Stanford-trained, board-certified anesthesiologist for more than 3 decades. And we're going to talk about anesthesia, what you should know about it, some of the differences of it, and some precautions. So good afternoon, Dr. Friedberg. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Michelle.
Dr. Friedberg has been interviewed extensively on the subject of anesthesia and propofol from Fox, CNN, True TV, People Magazine, and during the Michael Jackson murder trial. Dr. Friedberg developed the Friedberg method for administering anesthesia in 1992. And the Goldilocks Anesthesia Protocol in 1997. He's been published and cited in several medical journals and textbooks and was honored with a U.S. Congressional Award for applying his methods on wounded soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he is also the author of Getting Over, Going Under, The 5 Things You Must Know Before Anesthesia. Very, very important subject.
Well, thank you, Michelle. I'm excited to be here. And if I could start off with one of the things you mentioned in your discussion was the issue of control. And as you know, I'm a great advocate of using a brain monitor to titrate anesthesia. And one of the things I like to explain to the patient is that this device, the value proposition of the brain monitor, is that you actually are able to dictate your anesthetic dose, even though you're asleep and aren't speaking to the anesthesiologist. You're able to do that because of the numbers that come off the sensor on the forehead that's connected to the brain monitor.
So this is a brain monitor that's in the OR that you're connected to. And how accurate and how do we know that the brain monitor is accurate?
Well, next year will mark the 20th anniversary since it was FDA approved. There's over 3,500 published scientific studies attesting to it. And my own personal experience for the last 17 years is that it works absolutely wonderfully, specifically for drugs like propofol. It does not work particularly well for drugs like nitrous oxide or the Valium family, the so-called benzodiazepines, Valium and Versed and those type of drugs, because they act on the lower levels of the brain.
So if it's that easy to use, why don't more facilities have it? I mean, I've never had it.
Right. Well, part of the reason is that you don't know to ask for
it.
You see, and that was part of the basis of the book that I wrote, Getting Over Going Under, because the best available technology to make sure you're neither over-medicated or under-medicated is a brain monitor. And the reason I have the nonprofit Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation is that I don't want anyone to confuse my advocacy for the brain monitor with putting money in my pocket. I have neither myself or the foundation have any commercial relationship with the brain monitor maker.
So, but I still don't understand, though, if this brain monitor is really the safest way to put someone under,
right,
to monitor them, then why isn't it mandatory in every operating room throughout the country and private facility?
Funny you should mention that. That happens to be the goal of the Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation, is to make brain monitoring a standard of care. The problem with the monitor as it was originally configured is that when you turn it on from the factory, the so-called factory default setting, it only has the bispectral index or BIS number. And unfortunately, that's not a directly measured piece of information, much like if you're trying to drive your car with the rearview mirror, it's a lovely view of where you've been. It just doesn't tell you where you're going. So people thought it was going to make titrating anesthetics much easier, but it was only this year that the factory decided to change the default setting to include the real-time signal of the electrical activity of the muscle between your eyebrows.
I see. Do you think that in the future, then, this will become mandatory?
Well, that's the goal, and I'm trying to use the same model for change that got fathers in the delivery room. In other words, if you're going to have surgery again, you now know that you don't want anybody to play Russian roulette with your brain. You want them to measure directly the effect on your brain. And that comes off the sensor in the forehead. All those things that we put on your body, the blood pressure, the EKG, the cardiogram, and the pulse oximeter, only tell us what's going on at the bottom of the brain stem. But the anesthetics are designed to measure the top part, the cerebral cortex.
So then you would suggest any patient that is going to have any type of surgery and anesthesia that they ask for this brain monitor. And if the facility does not have the brain monitor, then what are their choices?
Well, especially in the elective world of cosmetic surgery, your choice is obvious to go elsewhere.
Sometimes that's a little difficult.
I agree. It's very difficult. But at least, you know, change doesn't happen overnight. As one of my friends used to say, change is glacial, especially in the medical field. First of all, people are so used to giving anesthetic on the basis of body weight and vital signs, heart rate and blood pressure changes, that they can't really grasp the idea that it's much better to directly measure the effect on the brain. And what I try to tell them is that, look, you would never give somebody a blood pressure medicine and fail to measure the effect on their blood pressure. Propofol, for instance, directly affects the upper part of the brain behind the forehead. So why would you give a drug that acts on that part of the brain and not measure it? So it's not like this is new technology. But one of the reasons I wrote the book is that you can't know to ask for something you don't even know exists.
No, it's very true. I want to talk a little bit, though, for our listeners about the different types of sedation, because I think that's very confusing. And when you're going under surgery and they talk about MAC anesthesia or deep sedation or general anesthesia, you really don't know what the anesthesiologist is talking about. So what is, let's start with minimally sedated. What does that mean?
Minimal sedation would be like if you took a oral Valium, 5 or 10 milligrams of Valium or 50 milligrams of Benadryl, you'd be basically awake, but just calm and relaxed. And again, when we talk about levels of sedation, the power of the brain monitor is to give you a numerical basis to define those levels. So minimal sedation would be 80 to 85 on the bispectral index, the BIS monitor.
Now, a lot of dentists use minimal sedation when they're pulling a tooth or you're having some root canal work. Is that called minimal sedated in the office? Where they give Valium and Halcyon and nitrous?
Those would be minimal sedations. Okay.
And now you're talking about brain monitors and minimal sedation. Does that mean your dentist's office should have brain monitors?
Probably not, because you're really not flirting with the airway that much. Now, I have seen dentists use a drug called methohexital or Brevetol to knock somebody completely out while they take their wisdom teeth out. That used to be a very common practice, but they don't make Brevetol anymore. And so propofol has sort of taken the place of that. And if you're going to have propofol, I think it's a really good idea to have a brain monitor, because there's as much as a 60-fold variation in how people respond to the same dose.
So you really need to be very well trained. And if your dentist is not well trained, then he shouldn't be administering those type of drugs.
Right. The oral and maxillofacial surgeons like to give their own anesthesia and do the surgery at the same time. Unfortunately, they have a mortality rate of about 1 a month throughout the country, but yet they like to claim that they're giving a safe anesthetic. I find it very discouraging, and if they would have this extra monitoring piece of equipment, they would probably do a great deal to diminish that mortality rate.
Well, it's very scary. I was recently at the dentist, and I had to have a wisdom tooth pulled, but it was loose already. So the dentist said, oh, well, this is going to be easy. And I said, well, I don't want to feel anything. And so he gave me some Halcyon, and I felt very coherent, like, okay, this is not working. He said, no, it's working. I said, no, it's not working. I said, I really need some nitrous. And he was hesitant. Because he did say to me, well, I've never really given nitrous and Halcyon, and I'm not quite sure about it. But in the end, he did give me a little nitrous, and it took the edge off.
Exactly.
And I didn't feel anything, and I guess I didn't remember anything afterwards. So he said,
perfect.
So I guess it worked, but it didn't feel like it was working at all. It was a very interesting experience, because I just felt, okay, this is not going to work, and it did. Going on then to moderate sedation.
Well, the line between moderate and deep sedation is a little fuzzy, and on the BIS monitor, as you're titrating propofol, it would be somewhere between 60 and 80. You could divide it up to 70 to 80 as moderate and 60 to 70 as deeper sedation. But at least you have some numbers to hang your hat on, whereas the definitions of moderate and deep sedation are a little vague according to the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Moderate sedation, they say, may require some assistance, whereas deep sedation may require some intervention. The problem is that they never define what is assistance and what is intervention. So I did that in my textbook, Anesthesia for Cosmetic Surgery. For me, assistance is anything passively you do to maintain the airway, which is to say to keep the tongue off the back of the throat. And that would include turning the head to the side and lifting the chin, the so-called facelift position, or putting an IV bag underneath the patient's shoulder to increase the force of extension on the chin, and again, pull the tongue up off the back of the airway. And then I would define intervention as any time you need to stick an oral airway or a nasal airway or a laryngeal mask, LMA, in to keep the tongue off the back of the throat. And that indicates a deeper level of sedation, like deep sedation.
Well, what does a patient have to understand when the doctor says, well, we're going to put you under moderate sedation? You know, most of the time during a consult or pre-op, the patient's mind is all fuzzy anyway.
Sure.
And they're listening, but they're not really listening until the day that they're there for their surgery, especially with elective surgery. Well, any surgery, but I'm talking specifically cosmetic surgery. And the anesthesiologist will say, well, we're going to give you moderate sedation. And most of the time, I think most patients say, okay, well, what is that? And they don't understand what you're talking about right now,
right,
with amounts and this and that. So in simple terms, what does that mean for the patient? Is that patient is going to wake up not feeling nauseous, not feeling sore, not feeling like she's going to vomit? I mean, how is that? Is that MAC anesthesia?
Well, currently, propofol is the backbone of virtually all MAC anesthesia. And the thing that the patient really wants to know is, how are you measuring the propofol dosage? That's really why the book exists, The Getting Over, Going Under, because without the ability to measure, the anesthesiologist is at best guessing. So in the offices in which I work, we have hard copies of the book Getting Over Going Under, and we also have an e-file which goes readily through the email.
All right.
And I'll be more than happy to send to any of your listeners at drfriedberg@drfriedberg.com.
So what you're saying is, I'm trying to get my head wrapped around this, when the anesthesiologist is saying moderate sedation, then it's really important for the patient to start asking questions. Well, how are you measuring the amount of sedation that I'm getting, and what is the cocktail that you're using? But shouldn't this be discussed before the date of the surgery?
And that's the reason we give the patients the books, because, again, the anesthesia is a great mystery, not only to patients, but to many anesthesiologists. And so it's nice to have the opportunity, when people have a chance to read it and contact the anesthesiologist by email or phone call, and discuss it. And it makes a world of difference, because there's no reason to go into something on the basis of, trust me, honey, it's going to be just fine.
Well, and that's usually what you hear.
Right. Well, that's the point.
Right. I mean, that's what you hear. And not every office around the country has your book.
Well, it's pretty darn easy to get. It is.
Well, you need to, right, we need to send it out to all these offices. I've never seen the book in any offices here in Northern California.
Right.
I would probably get the answer of, trust me, we know what we're doing. And usually the patient's got to trust the anesthesiologist. But they still have that fear of, am I going to wake up and how I'm going to feel? All right, so there's a fine line then between moderate and deep, and then deep and general.
Right. Well, once you go down below 60 on the bispectral index, between 45 and 60 is a level of sedation compatible with general anesthesia. The question then becomes, there's two parts of anesthesia. One is the sedation or sleep part, and the other is the analgesia, the pain part. And the reason that many people are using a synthetic narcotic like fentanyl or remifentanil with the propofol is it helps combine to take the pain away from having the surgery and the local anesthetic injection. But unfortunately, those type of drugs, the narcotics, morphine, Demerol, and those type of things, they aggravate or compound the breathing or respiratory depressant effect of the propofol. And that's really the fundamental difference between using the ketamine in a setting that I use it, and the way many people are giving moderate sedation or deep sedation with propofol plus narcotic. Now, when you have a general anesthetic, it can either be through intravenous or inhalational. The inhalational agents, of course, have both pain relief and sleep in the same drug, sevoflurane, desflurane, isoflurane. But when you're giving propofol, you either have to have adequate local anesthesia and titrate the propofol between 60 and 80, or you're going to use a synthetic narcotic and give what we call systemic or body-wide pain drugs like fentanyl and remifentanil.
What do you think, then, is the ideal cocktail?
Well, there is no such thing as an ideal cocktail, and I never claim that Goldilocks or brain-monitored propofol ketamine is perfect. I just say that it's better than the alternatives. The main reason that I prefer the ketamine is that the ketamine denies the brain the information that the body is having local anesthetic injection. So what happens under typical general anesthesia is the flow of information reaches the brain, but the general anesthetic stupefies the brain so it can't respond. And then when the patient wakes up in recovery room, that's when you have pain management issues. So with the ketamine, the brain never gets that information. And it's a very simple thing to do, and it's numerically reproducible because you're using a brain monitor, and there are the numbers. Once the patient goes below 75, they're protected from the side effects of the ketamine, which gave it a bad reputation.
Right. I was just going to ask you about that, because I've heard that it's a hallucinogenic.
Yes.
It's a street drug.
Yes, it is. It's a veterinary drug. It's even called a date rape drug, but it's beyond me. Let me explain very briefly the story of ketamine. 1958, the 50s were a very tough time for anesthesia. We lost more people from anesthetics than the polio epidemic. Very few people realize that. I think it was 1 in 10,000 was the death rate from anesthesia. So the researchers were looking for a non-narcotic painkiller, and the first class of drugs they looked at were the phencyclidines, and the parent compound was phencyclidine phosphate, PCP. Believe it or not, they marketed PCP in 1958 as Serenil, like everything is serene. So you can imagine that PCP had a very short half-life on the market. They marketed the drug as a complete and total intravenous anesthetic, which turned out to be pretty scary. But they thought they had a good idea, and they fiddled around with the molecule. In 64, they started working on ketamine. 71, they got FDA approval. But they learned nothing from their previous marketing experience. And again, they brought out ketamine as a complete and total intravenous anesthetic. Your listeners will picture a martini with the olive on the toothpick. The propofol is really the martini, and the ketamine is the small olive. And that's how ketamine is best used, as an adjuvant or an additive drug to propofol. But of course, in the 70s, we didn't have brain monitors. We didn't have propofol. So people used drugs like Valium. And that worked, but the problem with Valium is twofold. It did not have what we call readily identifiable clinical signs. And later on, of course, you couldn't measure it with the brain monitor. So it was a good solution for the time, but as time moved on towards the 21st century, I always like to say measuring is better than guessing.
And then in 2014, it was changed from a Class C to a Class B control drug,
yes.
Correct?
Because of the abuse potential in the street market for the drug. But it is a wonderful drug, like all of the drugs we have, if you know how to use it properly. And it's not a secret on how to use it properly, but the fear and the reputation of the drug is such that people have shied away from it. I'd like to think in the last 23 years of my publications and my lectures that we've led much more credibility to the use of the drug than it had before. And it is growing in popularity because it solves a very specific problem, which is not hurting the patient from the get-go.
Now, I also read that it can cause confusion, agitation, panic attacks,
absolutely,
impairment, and that it sometimes has been associated with the development of depression, as well as it can cause hallucinations.
Correct. And that is using ketamine as a sole agent. The whole point of what I started doing in 1992 was to first put the patient to sleep to shield them or protect them from all the crazy side effects. And every bad ketamine story you've ever heard is probably true because people were not using enough Valium or they weren't measuring the propofol. It's very simple to do, but you have to understand what the value proposition is for the patient. And I tell my patient, look, the first 20 years I gave anesthesia, never once did it cross my mind, why did I have to give drugs like morphine or Demerol when patients woke up from anesthesia? Well, duh, you know, surgery hurts. So you wake up, it hurts, you have to have pain medicine. Well, after I did my first 50 cases of propofol ketamine, nobody needed any narcotics and nobody was sick to their stomach because neither drug is a trigger for nausea and vomiting. And that's the difference between the synthetic drugs I mentioned before, the fentanyl and the remifentanil and those sorts of drugs. They are triggers.
So you basically use then the PK anesthesia exclusively?
Yes, for the last 23 years.
Do patients have to take an anti-nausea drug prior to their surgery with that combination?
It is not necessary, but sometimes when patients have had such bad experiences, if they want a dose of Zofran, I certainly won't fight them. It doesn't hurt the anesthetic technique. But again, as I explained to patients, if you don't throw the match in the gasoline, you don't need the fire extinguisher. And if you can take an anti-nausea medicine, but historically I have published the lowest rate of post-op nausea and vomiting in the literature simply because we're not using drugs like the smelly gases or the narcotic classes, which are notorious triggers for nausea and vomiting.
And what about Valium before?
Valium is fine. It doesn't really hurt the technique. You know, I've used Valium and I've also used an old-time blood pressure pill called Clonidine, which works just as well and people get very relaxed from, but sometimes there's a side effect of low blood pressure with that. So, you know, whatever the patient is comfortable doing, I try not to interfere with their belief system. They're dead set on wanting to take an anti-nausea medicine. Go right ahead. It's not a problem. My favorite patients, Michelle, are patients like you who've had terrible problems with nausea and vomiting after anesthesia, and they have this, and like you say, you wake up from the propofol, you feel great, and best of all, because there's no offending agents, you don't feel queasy or you don't throw up.
It was actually a great experience having anesthesia in this particular case. Plastic surgeons, though, they have their own philosophies regarding anesthesia.
Oh, boy. Boy, do they ever.
And, yeah. Yes. And a lot of them are still old school, will only
yes.
do general. A lot of them will only do MAC anesthesia, or what we decided that was moderate.
Right. MAC is really a billing term we coined in the late 70s so that the Medicare people would recognize a service for cataracts that we used to call local anesthesia with standby or local with IV sedation. So they coined this word monitored anesthesia care. And so the thing I hated about the term is that it suggests that other types of anesthesia weren't monitored, which is ridiculous. You know, nobody would do anesthesia without monitoring. But that made the Medicare people happy. But now it adds to the confusion, just like the terms right. Twilight anesthesia and sedation or moderate sedation, deep sedation. You now have the ability to have a number defining how deep are you going to be. And the patient doesn't really want to know how many drugs we know how to use. Patient just wants to know, yes, they're going to survive the experience. They're not going to be sick to their stomach, and they're not going to be in terrible pain. And so all of this is simple to reproduce. You know, when you mention plastic surgeons, of course, my favorite line goes back to my days at Stanford, when we used to say, you can always tell a Stanford man, you just can't tell him very much. It's a very protean expression. So, you know, you can always tell a plastic surgeon or an anesthesiologist, but you just can't tell him very much. People who've tried the brain monitor, who obviously, you know, it's not useful the way it came out originally, they already know that there's no point in trying to use it. And it's very hard to overcome that initial disappointment when they were told that this was going to be the answer to all their anesthesia questions.
Why do you think there's such a controversy still regarding anesthesia?
Well,
is it what the surgeons are used to?
Partly. The other part is that if everybody has a brain monitor, 20 to 30% less drugs get used. And that's a direct hit to the people who make the drugs, but it's an indirect threat to the people who benefit from that, which is the National Anesthesia Societies, both the physician and the nurse society.
So it's political.
Oh, it's very political and hugely economic. But, you know, if you're the patient lying on the table or about to lie on the table, you only want to know that you're going to get the best available technology to make your anesthetic experience as safe and as pleasant as possible. It's the old story. Measuring is better than guessing. It's just absolutely inexcusable to conduct yourself in the 21st century without measuring the effect on the brain directly.
Well, patients really have to be informed. And that's
yes.
The whole point of, well, that's one of the points of our conversation.
Yes.
They really have to understand what the difference is between all these different types of sedation right. and questions to ask before
yes.
they commit. And lots of times I find, especially in the world of plastic surgery, it's not as transparent.
No, it's very
as it should be.
You're right.
And it should be transparent because there's a lot of fears that go along with having the surgery. And I think that the surgeons and the anesthesiologists need to have a lot more transparency to explain to the patient exactly what's going to happen so that the patient has a peace of mind.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more.
What are some of the things then that both patients and anesthesiologists can do to come together? What are some of the ways that we can change this?
Well, basically, you know, information is power. If you read the book, you are completely empowered. Here, I'm going to show you the five reasons I wrote the darn book in the first place. First of all, like we said, you can't know to ask for something if you don't even know a brain monitor exists.
Correct.
Second, or why would you ask for one without the knowledge that too much drug can lead to delirium, dementia, and even one death, especially if you're over 50? And why would the general public not assume they would receive the best available technology for their anesthesia care, especially if it might improve their chance of waking up without brain fog? And why does postoperative nausea and vomiting still exist, and is there an established way to avoid it? And why does postoperative pain exist, and is there an established way to avoid it? All those questions are answered very simply in an easy-to-digest form for the general public. The book Getting Over, Going Under is not a technical book. It's written primarily for the general public because 6-7 years ago when I had to have my own hip replaced, I was terrified of having anesthesia. So I figured if somebody who's been making their living giving anesthesia is terrified of getting it, there's probably a lot of people out there who have anesthesia fears. And this book was directed to that effect.
Well, that sounds like a book that everyone should read and also every facility should have so that the patients do understand. I also noted that on your website, you have a checklist for patients going under general anesthesia, which I wanted to read off.
Okay.
Number one, any contact from anesthesia provider prior to surgery. So it should be yes. Will a brain monitor be used for my anesthesia? Should be yes.
Yes. Yes. I would point out if it's going to be something that's relatively short and relatively minor, like upper or lower eyelids, but any major surgery, you're going to be over an hour longer, you're going to suck out 5 liters of fluid, or they're going to give you new breasts, tummy tuck, facelift, that sort of thing. Anything that's relatively, you know, more than an hour, you should have it measured. There's just no doubt about that.
Okay. Number three, if so, at what level will you maintain or run my anesthesia? Between 45, between 45 to 60, or between 60 to 75% of awake value. So this is a little complicated for the average layperson to understand, unless they have the answer here, which it never should be below 45.
Correct.
Right? And then it says general anesthesia without local anesthesia, 45 to 60. What does that mean?
Well, in other words, sometimes the surgeon is less than perfect in terms of providing local anesthesia. You know, when you're at the dentist, if it still hurts after he's injected you, he'll inject again because you can tell him. But when you're asleep under general anesthesia, the only thing they can see is that the patient moved. And they usually, the surgeon will usually say, put the patient deeper. But if the brain monitor is there showing that you're already between 45 and 60, the answer is you need to put more local anesthesia. Just like when you're doing moderate to deep sedation, it's the same issue. The patient moves and the propofol level is appropriate for not hearing, feeling, and remembering, then you need more local anesthesia. And this is the most difficult thing for surgeons to accept, and the reason that patients wind up getting a breathing tube, which gave you the sore throat, and muscle relaxation, because then the patient isn't going to move whether you hurt them or not. And part of my thing for doing the technique I do is I don't want anybody to hurt or be hurt under anesthesia under my watch. I don't think it's acceptable, and it's certainly readily avoidable through measurement.
With these numbers, then, are the anesthesiologist able to determine these numbers without the brain monitor?
Absolutely not. The problem with vital signs is that they're notoriously unreliable guides to what's going on upstairs in the cortex. And the reason we know this is there was a study done by the American Society of Anesthesiologists about awareness under anesthesia, people who were awake when we thought they were asleep. Half the patients in the study showed no signs of heart rate or blood pressure changes. And then again, I'll get you back to the idea of the chicken without the head. You know the expression, the chicken ran around without a head, you know. You don't need a brain to generate movement. So the power of the brain monitor is to be able to tell the difference if the movement has something to do with the patient knowing what's going on or the patient not knowing, which is, you know, at the spinal cord level. It's hugely, hugely empowering for everybody taking care of the patient because you treat the correct problem rather than over-medicate or paralyze the patient to eliminate the movement.
Now, what do you do if you ask these questions now and the surgeon or the anesthesiologist says, well, this isn't necessary. We don't do that. We know what we're doing. I mean, that's like a bullying technique, but, you know, it happens.
Yeah, it does happen. And you say, well, the point of me asking isn't because you need it. The point of me asking is because I feel that I want it and I need it to be at ease when you're giving me anesthesia. And you want me to be at ease, don't
yes.
you?
Yes. Number.
Yes. So, yeah, there's a whole section in the book about negotiating this.
This sounds like a lot of negotiations. And also, I can see a lot of practices just trying to, for lack of another term, bully the patient into thinking that, oh, we don't need this because we know what we're doing.
Right. And I know you know what you're doing, but it's about me.
Right.
It's all about me.
But that is a problem with communications between surgeons and patients, especially in aesthetic medicine. But that's another conversation. We'll go on to number four. Will PK anesthesia be given for my anesthesia? And it should be yes.
Absolutely. Because the power of this is the power to deny your brain the information of the acute surgical insult.
If not, what kind of anesthesia will I get? And the answer here is spinal, epidural, nerve block, and brain monitor, propranolol sedation, inhalation anesthesia, stinky gases, are oxidizing drugs
yep.
and should be passé. Propranolol is an antioxidant.
Yes, it is. And so when I asked Mrs. Jones, do you want the oxidizing or the antioxidizing anesthetic? And she looks at me and says, what are you kidding? Is that a question? Of course I want the antioxidant. Why would I want to have a drug in my body that's going to raise my levels of inflammation?
Right.
Surgical insult in itself is an inflammatory response, but there's no reason to compound that by giving an anesthetic that aggravates the situation. And in the old days, they used to complain about using the propofol because it was so expensive. But now, since it's gone generic, there's really no legitimate argument to not be using propofol as the basis for anesthesia.
Okay. And then number six is, will local anesthesia be injected before incision? Answer should be yes.
Yes.
Will local anesthesia be left in my incision at the end of surgery? Answer should be yes. These are terrific questions. I have to tell you, I'm going to give this list to every one of my clients that I see that are going to have any type of cosmetic surgery, and I'm going to have them make sure that they bring this list with them to the surgeon
at the consult
and not wait. These are brilliant.
Excellent. Absolutely. Well, thank you.
That was number seven. Number eight, how soon after surgery can I expect to wake up? It'd be very soon, within minutes.
Yes.
Yes, I remember I woke up very, very quickly.
Right. Again, the propofol is a much shorter acting drug than anything else we've ever had.
Though you do read these stories on the internet where the patient claims to have felt everything while they're under anesthesia and they're having a cosmetic surgery and they're in pain and can't voice it to the surgeon. I've heard those stories.
And they're true, but they're very rare. And if you use a brain monitor, 80% of a very rare incidence would be eliminated, you see? And so the reason people put the breathing tube down the throat and paralyze the patient so they can't phonate, if the tube is sitting between your vocal cords, they can't do what we're doing right now, which is talk. And if you have muscle relaxants on board, you can't move. So this is a very horrifying and unpleasant experience, which is basically anesthesia under medication. You got medicated on the basis of your body weight and heart rate and blood pressure, but that's not where the action is. The action is behind your forehead. And so if you don't measure it, sooner or later, you're bound to be wrong. And that's a completely, not completely avoidable, but it's 80% avoidable by use of the brain monitor.
Makes sense.
It's not rocket science.
No, it doesn't sound like rocket science. It sounds like it's very easy.
It is,
you know,
very
I looked
easy.
Online. I saw the prices of these monitors range anywhere from, you know, $100 and some odd. Oh, there's some under 100, but they all go up to 15,000. I have no idea what the difference is, but there's quite a range in pricing of brain monitors.
Yes, there is. I can't tell you much because, again, I don't have any commercial relationship, but, you know, many of them can be obtained on eBay.
Right. Secondary market, I'm sure. Number nine is, how frequent is PONV in your practice?
Right. Postoperative nausea and vomiting, PONV.
Okay. There we go. I've had that. Should be infrequent, not usually more than once or twice a year.
Right.
Now, that's very interesting.
Yes.
So that'll be a telltale sign as to what mm-hmm. type of drugs the practice is using.
Right. You see, it's much more in the drug maker's interest to continue to come out with newer, more expensive drugs. The popular drug that was used for years was called Zofran, but once it became generic, then it was no great financial advantage to the company to keep marketing it. So they brought out a new drug, which I think is called Enmed or Emed, something like that, at $40 a throw. Well, once again, if you don't give stinky gases or narcotics, you don't need any anti-nausea drugs. So that makes me a very unpopular person with organized anesthesia and the drug companies. But it does make me a very popular person with people like you and my patients.
Well, that's what's important.
I thought so. I thought that was where it was at. Now, I don't begrudge the drug companies making money.
Well, the drug companies, that's a whole other conversation, right?
Exactly.
And number 10 is, what about shaking post-op? And yes, I remember I was shaking, not with the most recent anesthesia, but general anesthesia, definitely. You just can't
exactly.
stop shaking.
It does stop, but it's very annoying when you wake up and you're shaking
yeah.
and
yeah.
you're wondering, is this something bad?
Or
is
am
this
I
just,
afraid,
you know,
and cold? And,
exactly.
and the answer should be also infrequent. How soon
right.
do most patients go home after anesthesia? Should be within an hour or less, unless the surgeon requires
yes.
more observation time related to the surgery. And number
right.
12, what is your rate of post-discharge nausea and vomiting? Should be infrequent.
Post-op nausea and vomiting is usually defined as what happens when you're still in the surgeon's office or at the surgery center. But once you get discharged to home, that's post-discharge nausea and vomiting.
Oh,
right.
Okay,
and,
so they're two different things. You can be nauseous and vomit right. in the hospital or in the surgery center. And then when you come
yes.
home, you can be also
exactly.
nauseous and vomiting. Which is one thing that I hate is having to vomit. That is horrible.
And the problem is that nobody dies, Michelle, from nausea and vomiting. You only wish you were dead.
And number 13 is, what is your rate of patient satisfaction? Should be very high. So again, these are really excellent questions that I think every patient really needs to bring to the surgeon's office, because this is all about patient safety, and this is also about patient rights and transparency.
Exactly.
You know, sometimes these things they're tricky. You may really love your surgeon and be all set to sign on the dotted line and be really excited about the surgery. Then you come up with these questions and you don't get the answers that you want. And now you're in a real dilemma. And it's,
yes.
Do I trust the surgeon? Do I trust the anesthesiologist, even though I don't like the answers that were given based on these questions? Or do I decide now that I'm going to go elsewhere? It's psychologically, it's difficult. This is very tricky. And of course, if you put down a deposit, chances are you're not going to get your deposit
right
back either.
Well, that's another indication you're in the wrong office.
Right.
It's not like there's a shortage of people out there who do cosmetic surgery.
No, there's not.
That, you know, your girlfriends have all had Dr. Joe do their surgery, and you want to go where your girlfriends went because they all did well and everything was fine. And, you know, it's
in a perfect world, Yes. You should get back your deposit.
Right.
But I know for a fact that many practices will not give you back your deposit.
Right, and they should disclose that when they take your deposit.
Well, they should disclose.
Is it refundable or non-refundable?
Absolutely, they should disclose that. But you know, when I meet with clients, usually I meet with clients, I call them the virgin aesthetic patient. They
right
don't even know to ask these questions. And
exactly
it's not until
exactly
after the fact that they find out what revision policies are, they find out what the office policies are, refund policies, and by then it's already too late.
Exactly. And that's why your service is very valuable to these patients.
Thank you. Well, this has been very enlightening, Dr. Freeburg. I did want to ask you one other thing. What exactly happens to the brain during the sedation process?
It just becomes less able to process information that impacts the ears. People aren't yelling and screaming in the operating room and saying angry, hateful things. People tend not to remember their operating room experience. And one of the things I said in my textbook is that you can't control the emotional maturity of the people that you're working with in the operating room. Generally speaking, we really don't know why these drugs work. We only know at this point that we can measure how much the people are getting and what the result is. And once you're down below 75 on the bispectral index, the BIS monitor, you will not likely hear, feel, or remember the surgery.
I see.
General anesthesia, we're going to stupefy your brain to the point where it can't respond to negative stuff going up in the brain. For instance, they put you to sleep with general anesthetic and then they inject the local, typically cosmetic surgery. But the brain gets that information, and what it does with that is called the wind-up phenomenon, so that when you wake up from the general anesthetic stupefaction, you have to deal with pain, even though they've put local anesthesia in. But the problem is always that if that information reaches the brain, then the brain is going to not be very happy to know that the world of danger has now invaded the protected world of self. One of the things I like to tell people is, look, the brain doesn't tell the difference between a mugger's knife and a surgeon's scalpel. It only knows that the protective envelope, the skin, has been violated. And if you take that out of the equation, everything you thought you knew about surgery and post-operative experience changes dramatically. This is not a subtle difference. It doesn't require biostatistical analysis. People don't look like they've had surgery because they haven't been traumatized. And that is the power of the ketamine. So even for those people who are going to have general anesthesia, if you can encourage the anesthesiologist to give you 50 milligrams of ketamine 3 minutes before they poke you with the local anesthetic or cut you, your outcome will be much, much better.
That's very interesting. And I did want to also ask you just a little bit about Michael Jackson.
Sure.
Because you were asked to advise on his death, right? On the propofol, can never pronounce that.
Propofol, yes.
Overdose.
Yes.
And I think that has also created a negative response to the drug, and people are a little bit afraid because of that.
Right. And I like.
So, what do they need to know about this?
Well, they need to know that we don't blame the automobile for the drunk driver, and that Conrad Murray, Jackson's physician, was every bit as reckless giving propofol as a drunk driver is with the car. I make that point clear to the patients. There's a Michael Jackson chapter in the book, Getting Over, Going Under, specifically for that reason. So yes, Michael Jackson died while he was getting propofol, but he was getting it in the most reckless and cavalier fashion imaginable. In other words, you can't give propofol without monitors and not stay in the room with the patient and think that something good can possibly happen. And so when Mr. Flanagan had me up to his office in Glendale, he was trying to convince me what a great doctor Conrad Murray was and why I should defend him in court. He went on to say that when Conrad Murray did a cardioversion, which is a lower voltage of a defibrillation, that he didn't start an IV, which is standard safety practice. He just put the propofol straight in the patient's vein. And my eyes got big and my jaw dropped. And I said, well, Mr. Flanagan, you have impressed me, but not in the manner in which you had intended. That is completely reckless. And it's the mark of a sociopath like Conrad Murray. He'll never get a license to practice again because people recognize that he does not regard the normal rules of safety as applying to him. And that's just not acceptable.
That was tragic. And if there was a brain monitor in the room, this probably wouldn't have happened.
Absolutely. And I say that too. But the reality is, even if there was, if Conrad Murray had stayed in the room and watched his breathing and tipped his chin up, you know, to keep his airway open, he would still be alive. I mean, it wouldn't take much to have done this for a safe fashion. But he was too busy, distracted, talking to his girlfriend or whatever, and he left the room so he shouldn't wake Michael up while he was sleeping on propofol. It was just completely crazy.
Tragic. Yes.
Really, totally avoidable. That was the whole point. It was totally avoidable. And yet, there you have it.
Horrible, horrible, horrible. Yeah, and I think that spooked probably a lot of people regarding getting this drug for any type of anesthesia.
Well, hopefully they understand, your listeners will understand the difference between a drunk driver behind the wheel and somebody who's paying attention and is sober.
Oh, yes, yes. I agree. I hope so. Now, listeners can get a copy of your book on Amazon. Is that correct?
Yes, they can buy it or they can email me and I'll send it to them for nothing.
That's terrific. Your email address, what is that?
drfriedberg@drfriedberg.com. Friedberg is spelled Friedberg, and it's DR, no dots or dashes between the Friedberg. drfriedberg@drfriedberg.com. Happy to send you a free one.
Thank you. And your website is www.drfriedberg.com.
Yes, it is.
You also had a website for Goldilocks.
AnesthesiaFoundation.org.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So we got your website is www.drfriedberg.com. What other social media links do you have that people can get in touch with you? You have a YouTube channel. You're on YouTube.
The channel is Narcose, Narkose 3535. And on Facebook, of course.
On Facebook as Dr. Friedberg?
Yes.
Okay. LinkedIn as well?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And I want also to read this quote from you. The bottom line, says Friedberg, don't let your parents, your spouse, or anybody you love over 50 years old get general anesthesia without a brain monitor, or you may never speak to the same person again. This is so important.
Yes, ma'am. I think it is. I think it's critical. And the reason I do is that 6 years ago, the study came out that said one patient in America dies every day from anesthesia over medication. And the way you avoid that is to measure the effect on the individual brain. And it's not rocket science, and it's absolutely necessary for the public to generate the force for change, because all the things I've written and published and lectured about don't really count for very much in terms of changing physician behavior. It'll take a long time to get brain monitors as standard of care, but it won't happen without somebody like me trying.
Well, I want to thank you very much again for sharing all this information with our listeners, because it is very important information, and it's a lot that general public really does not know and does not understand. I want to thank everyone for listening. Please follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, NipTuck Coach. You can also email me at info@NipTuckCoach. You can listen to this podcast on Stitcher.com, Podbeam.com, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and SoundCloud. Remember, you only have one face and one body. Choose wisely. Thank you again for listening.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening. Join us next week for another exciting program about the world of cosmetic surgery and beauty. To learn more about Michelle Garber, go to www.niptuckcoach.com. To consult with Michelle directly, call 415-494-7211.